Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Thank you all for making it. We're going to be the number one media conglomerate in the world. The key here is act like a happy family. We're the Osbournes, and I'm Daddy fucking Warbucks, okay?
I always wanted one of you kids to take over.
People would do well to remember there's going to be a new sheriff in town.
Here's to us.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching Succession. I am Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us, what we do every week on Still Watching is we break down the latest episode of our current sort of TV obsession. Right now we are firmly aboard the HBO Succession train of this great season two. And today we will be talking about season two, episode four, titled Safe Room. And no other spoilers beyond that, just up to that episode. This is a great episode of television, and this season is just like, it's really killing it, Richard.
Yeah, it's humming along. And, you know, I've been a little bit wary of the show to kind of literalizing. It's like, I don't know, the real world, I guess. But I thought they handled like the whole thing of like, you know, a problematic news anchor and people protesting outside. There were subtle nods to like the Proud Boys and various other groups. I thought it was done without a heavy hand, which I appreciated.
Yes, we get the introduction of the problematic ATN anchor, and that's all handled like humorously but seriously. I don't know. I thought it's pretty great. And we get the introduction of Holly Hunter's character, Rhea Jarrell, the CEO of the Pierce News Group. So that all happens in this episode. We are going to do what we did last week, which is we're going to run down sort of like our list of who's on top, who's on the bottom of our various players. We've got the Roy family in the mix. We also have a couple peripheral players also on our list this week. Before we dive into that, I do want to read one quick email that we got from a listener. You can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you have something you want to say. This comes from Catherine, and she writes, one of the things that I love most about this show is that it has all these terrible, terrible, terrible men, and not a single one of them is rapey, not even Roman, not even at the Anything Goes sex club. The one time Kendall gets an intimation that his plus one to a party was instructed by her boss to be willing to sleep with him, he's revolted by the thought. The most boundary pushing we've seen anyone be is when Connor takes Molly and can't stop telling people he loves them, and even then the host of the party is like, this is not acceptable and you need to stop it right now. It's so refreshing. Everyone was always talking about how Game of Thrones had to be rapey in order to show what terrible people they are, and this show just proves what a hollow farce that idea is. Still watching, Catherine. I just thought that was something that actually hadn't even occurred to me, and I'm not saying that like Succession will never go there, but I think that's a really good point that Catherine makes there.
Well, yeah, I think the point about like, I don't think that we need to deny that that sort of, that exists in the world, obviously, but like,
absolutely.
I think that it, for a TV show that, you know, like there are many other ways that aren't triggering and harmful for people to show that someone's, you know, their character's a bad person. And I think this show figures it out, very well. And you're right. I hadn't really noticed it, but now that Catherine points it out, I'm like, oh yeah, that's really true. And good on the show for, finding a way to do that.
Yeah, exactly what you say. It's not to say that this doesn't happen, especially doesn't happen in these particular halls of power. And I don't want to like deny anyone's experience that that happens, but like, it's just not the only way to show men behaving badly or power abuse and stuff like that. And I applaud Succession for finding other intriguing storylines to explore.
Yeah. I mean, I think that also in this episode where they, where Connor goes to Lester's funeral and there's a confusion about whether his name actually wasn't Mo because that was a nickname. And there is a nod to this kind of cabal of men who it's like, what are they doing? You know, so like the show is not ignorant to it, but yeah, when that kind of thing is used as a kind of lazy plot device to explain someone's badness, like that cheapens the kind of real weight of the thing. And so it's appreciated that they don't rely on that as such a kind of easy dramatic crutch.
Yeah. So great point from Catherine. And if you have other great points y'all want to write in and let us know, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, you can. So we are going to start with our power list. And we like to start at the top because it's always fun to end on whoever's sniveling at the bottom. So we're going to start on top with a newcomer to the game, which is Rhea Jarrell, Holly Hunter's character. It's so fun. I'll just say right off the bat, you know, she comes in for this sort of sneaky meeting. She's sort of there on the one hand to offer up a diplomatic fuck off from the Pierce group, like we're not interested, but also like maybe she's a little interested. Maybe she personally is a little interested, even if her board or the family is not. And so she's playing it at 9 different levels, which is always fun to see. It's also fun to see Holly Hunter. If you're a longtime fan of Holly Hunter, it's just fun to see her in this context of like a media news group, given that one of her best roles of all time is in broadcast news, a perfect film. And she's got like the bob. I mean, it's not quite the perm, obviously that she had in broadcast news, but she's got the short power bob going. So, it's pretty great. So yeah, Richard, why do you think Rhea Jarrell deserves to be on Hop this week?
Well, the whole, no thanks, I'm not hungry. Like we mostly eat Pulitzers over it. Like that whole kiss off to that thing. I mean, I just think that like it's a well-written character, obviously played by a brilliant actress. But I like the kind of inversion in this episode where we're seeing the Roy family have to kiss the ring a little bit, you know, and it's funny because they're the kind of big lumbering thing trying to buy the thing. They're throwing money at it. I mean, you know, at one point, Rhea is like, you're just bidding against yourself now because they keep raising the price. Right. And yet they have to, this is a kind of odd sort of passive aggressive courtship. And I like that Rhea kind of, sits there centered, not flinching and just kind of like tells them how it is.
Absolutely. And, what I also appreciate is she's in there. Like, who knows what would have happened if she had left with, you know, there's this lockdown. She has to stay. She's in the panic room with the top members of the family. So she gets a little bit more of the pitch because she's forced to stay. But what I find interesting is when they switch the TV back over, to ATN, she's like, I kind of get it. It's full of vim, full of piss and vinegar. Like the Pierce group is looking all the way down its nose at this Fox News, analog. They're in the midst of this scandal with this newscaster that they have. She has every reason to be completely on her high horse. And then she like gives them a little something. She's like, I kind of get it. I get the appeal of this to some people, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, she kind of expressed a semi-sarcastic kind of like, well, that was quite an experience, like just even sort of the kind of clandestine way she had to enter the building, you know, and she seems sort of wryly amused by the whole thing. And I think that's a really interesting, I don't know, depiction of the way that when people are in these sort of positions of power and they know other people who are in positions of power and they know them in a business sense, but also sort of a social sense, a sense of living in the same city, traveling in the same circles, I feel like politics do blur a bit. And I think that Rhea comes in there and yeah, she's, you know, driving a hard line, but also I think like, I don't know, find something entertaining about it. And like, I think that explains why a lot of people, you know, when this current presidential administration will like invite Ivanka and Jared to their parties. You know what I mean? Like, I think that it becomes a sort of game. And I think that that was sort of well represented in this episode.
This is the first time her reaction to Shiv, Shiv, who's like supposed to be there, but not supposed to be there. And we'll get to her. It was the first time I started to think about Shiv as Ivanka, as the palatable face of this mm-hmm. family for some people. Not for a lot of people. Plenty of people don't find her palatable at all, but like she's the one you can, and Ivanka and Jared are the people you can invite to the dinner party. You know what I mean? When you couldn't invite, Eric or, et cetera, Don Jr. So there you go. So there's Rhea at the top. One thing I do like is, you know, they mentioned that they wanted to bring Frank back into the fold. Because he, you know, good old Shakespeare Frank, right? And he makes a mm-hmm. Coriolanus reference, in this episode, proving his like Shakespeare bona fides. And then something Rhea says, like, as soon as she gets there, she's like, oh, I feel like Cleopatra smuggled in the carpet or something like that. You know, it's just like, it's a different kind of, rich power broker person that we're dealing with here, which is the like sort of snobby intellectual elitist kind, our kind of people, I think, Richard. So,
yeah.
So here we go. All right. So let's go to, number two on our list, which is Greg. Greg doesn't, spend a lot of the episode on top of the power list. You know, he's sort of being shuffled. He is a voice of reason. He gets shuffled into basically like an office, an unused office, and rightly points out that this is not any kind of panic room. He gets water bottles thrown at him by Tom, but at the end he makes his play, which we've been waiting for the payoff since the Thanksgiving episode last season, which is that he kept a few documents from the like cruise scandal paperwork that he was asked to shred by Tom, and he's like, I'm calling it in. But also, like, that's not the last time. He, you know, because he's not like, he doesn't give it up. He's like, I have this leverage. I'll never tell you where they are. But he's playing it sort of slow and steady, which I like.
We never really found out what this cruise scandal was, right?
I believe it's like, it's everything bad that ever happened on a cruise. That the way in which Waystar Royko covered it up. So any sexual assault that ever happened, any, like, it's all bad is what, like, there was a scene last season where Tom sort of started enumerating what all the bad things were.
Right.
And like sexual assault, speaking of which we were speaking of earlier, like, stuck out to me, but it's just like all the like terrible scandals that could, you know, like, I don't know, violence or robbery or like whatever it is, whatever's happened, ever happened on a cruise ship, how they've buried it and hushed it up with like money and what have you.
I see. Okay.
So
a litany of sins.
A litany of sins. There you go. So there's this great scene. I'm sure people remember last season where Greg on Thanksgiving has to go shred the papers. And there's mm-hmm. just like, it's one of my favorite scenes because he's like, this goes away. He's at this like giant shredder machine and he sort of made himself like a little sort of song, like rhyming thing to remember. He's like, this goes away. This saves the day, and saves the day is the like top piece of paper that he's grabbed to save for himself. And he just keeps doing that for like a while. And so he's got this like dossier basically of incriminating, evidence. And I really like the way that conversation goes. This is a great episode again. For Tom, and we'll get to Tom. It's a great episode again for Matthew McFadden, but, the tenor of their conversation when he's calling in his blackmail and Tom's like, are you asking me if you can blackmail me right now? And then it's just like laughing and joyful, but also charged. It's a fascinating, exchange.
Yeah. Because you wonder, like, I don't know. I think I find myself wondering this about a lot of characters in the show. Like, does Logan actually really believe in the news? You know, like, trying to locate some sort of humanity. And I feel like that the Tom Greg relationship is one where like it's maybe the most close to the surface, you know? And I'm curious to see how the show kind of teases that out, if it does at all.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. As we said, we'll circle back to Tom, but he is obviously not near the top of the list. We also have another non-Roy player, which is Jerry. Richard, do you want to explain why Jerry is number three on our list this week?
Well, she made it into the real panic room. which would suggest, I mean, I granted she was probably by Logan's side, so she just got swept up in it, but still she got in the room, which felt like a coup. But I also think, you know, I had brought up earlier in this season about like my questions about Roman's sexuality. Were they teasing that he was maybe not 100% straight, whatever. Well, we kind of cracked some of the case in this episode, thanks to Jerry.
Right.
Which is its own kind of power, right?
Yes, absolutely. She's got extra power in the Roy family now, in this newfound sort of dynamic with Roman. Something that, we should, I mean, I'm no expert in any of this, but, what it seems like to me is, like a dom submissive thing is what, Roman is looking for. He's looking, he tries to have, you know, sort of more vanilla phone sex with Tabitha. He gets, grossed out by, you know, her making things explicit or just even like her sort of standard seduction voice. And he needs to feel like bad about himself in order to feel, in the moment. So that is something that Jerry can provide for him.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yeah, and it's a turn. You know, obviously they've established Jerry and Roman's connection pretty carefully this season so far. I guess that was maybe in essence building to this moment in this episode. But it still surprised me. You know, I didn't really think, and I think that part of what surprised me, and this is my own biasly speaking, is that like I just didn't expect Jerry's character to be sexualized in that way, you know, or really anyway, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really know anything about her personal life. But we know we see her kind of drinking a martini, you know, having eaten takeout, you know, like, so we get the sense of like some sort of quiet home life. But like, I don't know, I guess like, I think because she's an actress of a certain age and a character of a certain age, I just like didn't think it was going to happen. I certainly not in this form. So that's a pleasant surprise.
I love it. I love it. Not just from like a, I don't know, I'm just like, oh, here's something different. And here's something that's different that doesn't feel different for different sake. It feels like once this is kind of revealed as what Roman needs, you're just sort of like, of course. And actually, like, I watched some of these episodes where I saw this dynamic play out. And then I went back and rewatched the episode in the first season where we see him interact with his mom. Because, like, you know, that's part of this, not, you know, it's demonstrably part of this. In this episode, in an earlier phone conversation with Jerry, Roman goes, yes, mommy, like,
yeah.
That is how he views her and to a certain degree. And that is part of the arousal for him. So I was like, interesting. Did they sow any seeds for that in the first season? So I went back and rewatched like the wedding episodes to sort of see how Roman interacted with his mother, played by Harriet Walter. And they actually don't have them interact very much at all. She's like talking to Shiv and talking to Kendall, and she's not really talking to Roman. And so I will be curious to see if we get Harriet Walter back this season and if we get to see sort of how the stem of some of his mommy issue stuff. But some of the seeds, and once again, I don't pretend to be an expert in any of this. So if you want to, and I'm never here to yuck anyone's yum. So I'm not like, whatever Roman needs, it's consensual. Jerry seems to be like kind of enjoying it too. Great. Yeah, I'm all for it.
Playful in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm all for it. But I wonder, and so I don't want to say that like, you know, sub-dom relationships or whatever have to come out of any kind of trauma. I don't think that that's the case, but the most sexual information we do have from Roman in the first season is this. The reason I call it sexual is it comes up in when they're in the sex club in the first season, or the whatever club you want to call it. And, he mentions this thing that used to happen when they were kids where he was like put in a cage, and treated like a dog, and he had to like eat his kibble out of a bowl before he was let out of a cage. Like, this is a real way in which he and Kendall both were, abused by their family. It feels of a piece. I once again don't want to say it's one-to-one like child abuse to this kind of sexual proclivity. It's definitely not. But this idea that he was put in a, you know, probably put in like a literal dog collar as a kid, and then like this is something that he's interested in. I don't know. It feels of a piece to me. So, but if you listening are like, Joanna, you have it all wrong, or I have opinions on this, please email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I am very interested to know what people think. So that is the Jerry Roman dynamic. I love it. I'm really into it. That brings us to number four on our list, which is Logan Roy. Logan actually is fairly quiet and subdued in this episode. And actually the most repeated thing that he says throughout the episode is like, where's Kendall? Is Kendall okay? Where's Kendall? That's actually like a repeated thing that he does. But he's making moves towards getting what he wants. Like, it's not a no from Rhea in this, at the end of this episode, really. So the quiet, subdued sort of thing that he's doing in this episode is working for him.
Yeah. You know, it works. And I like when he kind of was saying, you know, I know I'm a terrible old bastard that everyone hates, but like, I really do love the news. I love news people. I kind of wonder how much of that is true, and I want to see more of that. I'm curious about, you know, it's why I loved the episode with Walter, because I like seeing what their business actually is, you know, the process of it. I don't want this to become a newsroom show, but, you know, just the little glimpses into the world of, you know, the news network and its various personalities. Like, I find that really, fascinating. And so I like kind of Logan addressing like that maybe long ago, you know, there was some actual passion for the craft, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't sure whether or not I believed him in that moment.
Yeah.
I wanted to believe him.
And maybe he wanted to believe himself, you know? I think that, you know, I think this deal is going to be one of the kind of bigger arcs of the season, and it'll be interesting to see like, is he intent on destroying this venerable news organization? Is he actually trying to draft off of its respect and sort of have that blowback on the rest of his company? Like, I don't know. And I'm really like eager to find out.
The other thing that, he says there is he, you know, Shiv is trying to put her oar in this negotiation, and she's like, well, to preserve the culture of Pierce, we could put certain like structures in place that guarantee you sort of editorial autonomy or whatever it is that you're after. And Logan cuts right through that, and says, listen, we know that's bullshit. We know that whatever structures we put in place, I can find a way around it if I want to. So the real question is, do you trust me? And I just thought that was fascinating, a fascinating question from that character to be like, do you trust me? Like, if I say I'm not going to fuck with your model, I'm not going to fuck with your model. And I'm like, as an audience, what are we supposed to do with that when we've seen him double cross people at every turn in this series? So like, are we supposed to take that as completely disingenuous? Or, you know, is this a different kind of relationship for him? What was your read on that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess we've only gotten our sort of, you know, this glimpse of Logan, but it's like, why on earth would anyone trust you? You
right.
know? And I think that in a way, like, I think in a way he was more saying like, look, you have to even, like, you have to even pretend to yourself that you trust me, because that's part of doing a deal like this, you know, like, yeah. Like it is a suspension of principle in a way, or at least a kind of, forced bending of principle, like of what you kind of already know, because you want to force something through, you know? I mean, I think it was a, you know, and I'm also wondering, given, you know, we're talking about Logan on the power ranking, like, how much of this, like, shooting and then the lockdown and the whole thing about, you know, ATN under attack, like, how much of that was sort of coincidental or whatever, you know? I don't know. I wonder, like, just how hard he's pulling the strings, you know?
I think making sure that she's in the panic room could be seen as, like, a power, like, a smart mm-hmm. gameplay. I don't know that he can, like, pull the strings on, because it was an employee who committed suicide because of, like, you know, a bullying in the newsroom or something like that. And so, like, I don't think that he could have pulled the string on that, but I suppose he could have pulled the string on, like, the extent of the lockdown and that Rhea was not allowed to leave, that sort of thing, you know?
Right.
All right. That brings us out of the building and over to Connor Roy, who, because everyone is in lockdown, is the only member of the Roy family who makes it over to Mo/Lester's funeral. I want to give this actually, you know, we've got Connor in at number 5, but I actually want to give this as a joint Connor Willa sort of spot, yeah. Because she really shines as his partner, in this scenario. And she's funny. In her sort of like grappling with all of this. But also, you know, her playwright skills come through in the eulogy that she recrafts for him. Like what did you think of the funeral stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Willa, because also she gets a little mission. You know, like the family, whatever. And Connor's like, hey, good, like you're in or whatever. Like they tell her, go find out from Mo/Lester's widow what he said to this biographer, you know?
Right.
And so she's being included in the intrigue, you know? And, so good on her. I mean, she's, you know, currently embroiled with a kind of buffoon, but like, oh well. I think that like Connor being sort of comic relief, while trying to, you know, grease the path to power or whatever, is always some of the lighter stuff on the show. It's some of the sillier stuff. And yet at the same time, you know, kind of according to your, I think probably pretty accurate prediction that maybe next season he will be president of the United States. I think that makes the sort of buffoonery that much more chilling if you think about the kind of long arc of what this potentially could be. Showing up and making kind of an ass of yourself at seemingly a powerful person's funeral and being excited about the funeral because it means you can fundraise and sort of not being coy about that at all. Like, he seems like a real dum-dum, but like, well, you know where dum-dums can go.
Well, on the one hand, yes, obviously I'm never going to like defend Connor's intelligence, but on the other hand, like he handles the biographer, you know, she's back, she's prying Michelle Pencil, I think is her last name, something like that. And I'm impressed with her. Because like you and I are like quote unquote journalists, we're culture. We've discussed this before, how we sometimes don't know how to categorize ourselves. You're a critic. I'm a whatever, but we're not like really aggressive, hard hitting journalists. And I really admire, the skill it takes to get people to talk when they don't want to talk to you. And so the way that she is trying to like, bring his guard down and be like, I'm not interviewing you. We're just talking at a funeral. And he's just like, he gives her this version of no comment. It's good. Like he does a good job with that, the deflection. So he has at least a few brain cells to rub together there.
Oh yeah. I mean, he has his own brand of savvy, you know, I mean, yeah. I don't think that you could be raised in this, you know, kind of family without developing some of those skills. But, he also, because of the family he was raised in, I think, has falsely assumed that he is himself a titan of, you know, the industry, a sort of master of the universe, when it's like, well, no, you just kind of were given that. You haven't actually proven that you deserve it or that you can kind of wrestle it out of that power out of nothing.
I think that's true. Just shout out to Alan Ruck, who plays Connor, his comedic timing, because there's just something about the way that he delivered, like, when they were talking about Mo and Lester, and he's like, old Mr. Fiddlesticks, and he's like, Dad wouldn't let us in the pool with him. Like, just the way that he sort of casually unrolls that whole thing is
this, like, horrifying.
Dark and funny at the same time. So,
and then an implication, Willa kind of panics. She's like, I mean, all of those guys, what, I don't think you should be here. I don't think you should be giving a speech here. You know, like you're like, what is actually happening? You know, but yeah, you're right. Alan Ruck just handles that comedy so well. I think it's such an incisive performance.
And like, what did they feel free to tell Willa at a funeral? Like, what did she learn about the Wolfpack's antics at a funeral? Like, that's just So, I'm really looking forward to, I hope this biography hits and we hear all the things. So there you go. I would like read this fictional biography of Logan Roy and his various antics. All right, that brings us to number six on our list, which is Roman Roy, also not, though he does get locked down in his remote location, but he is out at management training. Like I said last week, this is exactly where we met Greg in season one, episode one. In that episode, Greg gets like super stoned and then vomits out of his like costume that he has to wear as he's walking around the park and sort of washes out of the program. Roman doesn't get that bad, but he does, like, you know, say some salty things in his turkey costume and stuff like that. But he meets a guy, Brian, and, you know, he doesn't do terribly. He's doing okay, maybe, in the management program. And he figures out his sexual kink. So, congratulations, Roman. You're doing okay.
Yeah, I mean, and here's another, you know, member of this family who, like, is not without his own savvy, is not without his own skill and intelligence. I mean, you know, and he's sort of doubting of the fact that, like, his pitch got picked up with his partner, you know, but he's like, it's just my name. And the partner's like, no, I actually don't think it is. I think they like the idea, you know? So yeah, I mean, I don't really see him being much of a contender in the sort of vying for the crown exactly. But I think he's probably destined for something sizable.
The comment that his partner makes, so his partner, the character's name is Brian. He's played by Zach Cherry, who's a comedian that I really like. And I really love, like, I don't know, I kind of love this casting. He's like this very unassuming, but when he starts talking and he's like, I'm intellectually promiscuous, but creatively conservative, stymied by a variety of enemies. Like, it's just like, it's, you know, it's just great. Another great Succession character. But another line that Brian has is, he goes, no one has ever gone bust overestimating America's interest in violence, which is a very great and true line. And he's just sort of like, yeah, you're onto something here. Like, you got it. Mm-hmm. Yep. VR violence. And then, I guess the last thing I want to say about the Roman Jerry thing, just to circle back, is even before this last phone call they have here, her first phone call to him, she goes, is it very horrible in America? Like, he's like out there in real America. Is it very horrible? So Roman and Jerry are OTP. All right. So in our number seven spot, we have decided to make it a tie between Logan's poor beleaguered children, Kendall and Shiv. Shiv, her first day at the office, Kendall possibly contemplating suicide the whole episode. Both of them sort of being played off against each other, unsure of what they're meant to be doing necessarily, trying to find connection with each other, not being able to connect, and at every turn, just puppets for their father. I had like so much sympathy for both of these characters in this episode, but they are not in a very strong place, either of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing with Kendall. I mean, I like the scene where Shiv kind of confronts him and is like, what is it? What is it? Is there some deal that you and Dad have struck, you know? And she has no idea that the deal is just basically Logan saying, you killed somebody and I'm not going to, you know, you have to kind of stand next to me or else, you know, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And so the tragedy of, from Kendall's perspective, of Shiv thinking that he's done something, I don't know, positive or strategic or whatever, when actually it's sort of the opposite, or entirely the opposite. I think that's an intriguing dynamic. And I also think the way that, you know, Logan is, you know, asking, where's Kendall, the way that he seems to have softened to him is turning to him for, you know, counsel and whatever. I think part of that is that he can be friendly and to some degree affectionate with him, or, you know, express a care for him because he's got him beat, you know, he's not any sort of challenge anymore. And so he can soften, which I think Kendall is probably keenly aware of and is, you know, kind of compounds the tragedy, I guess.
Yeah. And this, I guess the thing that I am constantly looking for, the tragedy of Succession, sort of as you allude to, is like, if these kids could just band together, they would probably be happier, healthier, and win. And the toxicity of the whole situation is that Logan just constantly plays them off each other. And so that's what's happening here, is like, you see how powerful Kendall and Shiv could be, honestly, if he were able to tell her what's going on, and if she were able to offer him the compassion support he needs. I mean, like, okay, poor Boohoo Kendall, he killed a guy, like, you know, or didn't, you know, like, I'm not saying, like, you know, he behaved badly last season, but it's also eating him up. And so I think we have to find sympathy for him, or else, like, we're completely outside of the plot of season two, you know? But the same with Roman, like, Roman and Shiv and Kendall, like, they're all constantly sniping at each other because that's exactly where Logan needs them to be. And it feels like that's why Logan, like, I don't know why Logan brought her in, but he's certainly not looping her in while she's there. She doesn't feel brought in this episode.
Well, yeah, I think we're seeing in this episode, like, Logan, and we saw it earlier when, you know, in another episode where he was saying, yeah, you know, we'll send you to Hong Kong for 6 months, we'll do this. And it was like kind of pushing this thing down the field about, you know, 3 years. Is that, like, in concept, sure, I'll offer it to Shiv, you know, I she's more in my good graces than the other three are. But, like, the closer it gets, the more it becomes a reality that, you know, he's just like, he really, Logan really, like, bristles about that. And I think watching Shiv realize that in this episode was intriguing, because, you know, she was sort of the cat that ate the canary, like last episode, you know, since she was offered it, basically. And to see that kind of, I don't know, contentment, kind of punctured is interesting.
That description of this one particular face that Sarah Snook makes as Siobhan, the cat that ate the canary, is perfect. Like, that is the look she gives sometimes when she, like, can't contain the smile, like, barely trying to contain the smile.
Like, what, like, in last episode where Logan calls and, you know, he's like, she's the only one who wasn't at the boar hunt or whatever and didn't express anything negative about the potential you know, new acquisition, and she, yeah, she gives that little smile that's just like, it's working for me.
Yeah, but so in this episode she's like, why am, you know, she, Jerry's in there giving her some, like, reports or whatever, and she characterizes it like, oh, why am I'm in here with a coloring book. Sort of like, I'm being babysat, I'm being shoved aside, I'm not being included in these conversations. I didn't know Rhea Jarrell was in the building. Like, you know, if I'm being brought in, why aren't I being brought in? And so she tries in this panic room scene to show how valuable she can be as helping a negotiation, what she can offer as a palatable face of the company or what have you. And it's what she makes the fatal error, in that scene where she goes, basically, Logan won't be here forever. Like, yeah, you don't have to worry about Logan because Logan will be here forever. And that is where Logan sort of cuts in sharply.
Like, I mean, he yells at her in front of the CEO, yeah, which is, like, super, mm-hmm, you know, embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's that exactly what you already said this, but, like, any indication that, like, he won't always be the king, is a surefire way to set him off. So, you know, if Siobhan wants to play this game, she needs to remember that.
Siobhan is Conan O'Brien and Logan is Jay Leno.
You know, we also find out, it's interesting, we find out that Kendall is, like, giving his dad the medication, like, really caring for her and him. And Siobhan is, like, really weirded out by this. And I don't know if she sees it as, like, too much of a trusted power place for Kendall to be in charge of the medication. She's just, like, really put off and weirded out by it. And so then I'm put off and weirded out by it and trying to figure out, like, you know, why I should be.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to approach this show with a sort of more compassionate, humanistic lens, like, it's really sad that these kids can't see any exchange of care or intimacy passing between child and parent as anything but a strategy, you know?
Yeah, game. Yeah.
As anything, like as if there, and there really is a finite amount of Logan's attention, and if, you know, Kendall's getting 6 units of attention, then that means Shiv only can, you know, fight for the last, the other 4, you know? It's sad.
Absolutely. All right. So I'm sorry. I just said absolutely. So after you said it's sad, I do want to dwell on one last, like, really sad, interesting, aspect of the episode, which is, Kendall's frequent trips to the roof, his sort of like, you know, staring out over the edge, getting close to the edge. And then the next day when he goes into the office, there's glass put up. So, like, if he were thinking of throwing himself off the top of the building, like, there's now safety glass there so that he can't.
And does that mean he was being observed, you know?
Exactly. Like, that he was being watched. Where's Kendall? Where's Kendall? Where's Kendall is something that Logan asks over and over again, as I said. And so, like, this idea, and we find out that we already saw him shoplift. He like shoplifted some batteries and threw them out. Like, we already saw that. I don't think you and I really dwelled on it, but that's like a thing that he's been doing. We found out that the company knows about it and is handling it. And that Colin, who's their fixer, sort of like has his eye on all things Kendall. So yeah. So this idea that like when he's going up here to the roof to like have his quiet alone time and a cigarette and whatever, he's being observed.
Mm-hmm.
What's funny is it's not funny, haha, but I watched this episode when they first put the screener up, on our, this is a little inside baseball, but like on our media site, a while ago, and, it still had like sort of some temporary VFX in there, and they had only put the glass up like right where he needs to put his forehead up against the glass, and the rest was still blank and open air. It means they digitally put in like the rest of the glass on that roof. And so when I saw that, I was like, is this temporary VFX or is this like a gesture, like an even more we're watching you of like, we've just put the glass in the one place where you like to stand. And the rest is open. But then when I saw it with like the full thing in, I was like, well, yeah, that makes more sense. Okay. it was just temporary VFX. All right. So last on our list, always most entertaining, is Tom, Womgance, who gets, saddled with this, a Nazi, or fascist, anchor, and having to deal with that, having to deal with his being in the beta panic room, the not real panic room.
It's literally just a room.
Like a room.
Not secure.
And I just love that, like, when he talks to Shiv, he's like, who's in there with you? Like, who's in the real panic room? Am I in the wrong room? He has to deal with Greg trying to break up with him. And he throws a water bottle in a way that satisfies all of us who were upset we didn't get the tossed ice cream in Big Little Lies.
Uh-huh.
At least we got Tom throwing some water bottles. And then he is forced to give Greg a raise because Greg outmaneuvered him. And also, like, sort of support Shiv, but not, you know what I mean? Like, it's this thing with Tom where he's like excited for Shiv, but also jealous of Shiv and like wary of all of this. So, poor Tom's on the bottom this week.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like you said, it's still very entertaining. I mean, I think that the scene where he's sort of running down this checklist of questions with the potentially fascist news anchor, and he mentions that the dog is named Barbie, just like Hitler's dog, and the anchor's like, different spelling, and he's like, oh, different spelling, and like watching him realize, like, oh my god, this guy's a fucking Nazi.
Yeah,
like, it's just so funny. And also I loved when the alarm goes off and he just goes barreling down the hallway. He's like, executive's coming through. It's just so embarrassing.
But
he definitely came out last in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sort of like really delicate way that he's like, when he asks if he's read Mein Kampf, and he goes a couple times, and he goes, "Oh, are there Easter eggs you didn't get the first time?" Like, and then yeah, and then when he talks about this guy whose name is Ravenhead, Mark Ravenhead, I believe, talks about Europe decimated, and he mentions like the German troops or the Polish troops that died, and doesn't mention the millions of Jewish people who died. And he's like, just check in the till, bud, you're short a few million. Like, yeah. Just the like Midwestern way he couches trying to grapple with these atrocities. And it's like, you can, you know, and he's like, or the scene. Okay. So he's like turned this, guy who works for him into like a human footstool. Awful. And he's sitting there and he's talking to Greg, and he's like, "Nazis, they're terrible, right?" Yeah. You know, and Greg's like, "Yeah, Nazis bad." So yeah, it's a great performance of a worm-like character. Mm-hmm. not doing his best. Something that I didn't mention in Greg's section that I should have is a great Sid Peach line where she's talking to him and she goes, "You're like a farmhand with his coat. Do you have to milk him?" About how Greg deals with Tom. So just like great, great, delicious peachisms, all over the place. Absolutely. Is there anything else, you want to mention of this episode?
No, I feel like we kind of hit all the major points. I just, you know, welcome Holly Hunter. Happy to have her.
Yeah. I mean, so great. So freaking great. And next episode, we get the great Cherry Jones. So like, it's just, you know, I was actually talking to, discussing name drop. I was talking to Casey Bloys out of HBO at TCA. And I was telling him that like how much I love Succession, but how it's a hard sell for some people because they see it as like these, you know, white men behaving badly show. And he's like, "Yeah, but this season we have Holly Hunter and Cherry Jones." And I was like, sure, sure. Yes. I mean, I'm already on board, but if you want to throw some awesome women at the problem too, that's great too. I guess the last thing I want to say about Tom, before we wrap it up is we talked last week a lot about, the way in which Shiv mistreats Tom and maybe underestimates like how far she can push him. But what we've always seen with the Shiv Tom thing is like Shiv pushes Tom around. And then Tom pushes Greg around, or this guy that he's treating as a human footstool. You know what I mean? Like he's just, mm-hmm. You can't feel too bad for Tom because he's just like, you know, paying it forward basically. And when Greg tries to sort of like quit, he goes, something about like, I won't lose what's mine or something like that. Which is, you know, very, they always couch it in this sort of like love relationship, this like very possessive lover sort of thing. But I think that's not just for comedic effect, but also to show that this is how Tom endures sort of what he endures from Shiv sometimes, is sort of gets it out this way. So there we go. Okay. Next week it is, the Roys and the Pierces, and we will see how that, all turns out. Until then, Richard, where can people find you?
I'm going to be down at Pierce News Group eating some Pulitzers. I think. For the tweets I'll be tweeting from Rylaz and the things I'll be writing for VF.com. Joanna, where will you be until next week?
You will find me in a turkey costume wandering true, real America. Other than that, you can find me at VF.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and we will see you all next time.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.